So we have a little time. Does anyone want to raise a topic, an issue, something they'd like to talk about?
Is anyone here curious about TV yet, but has not been into it? Have any questions about television yet?
I got Schenectady for the first time 2 years ago, Channel 6 in Schenectady, after trying for 30 years or so.
On digital?
On digital. I never got on analog because of Philadelphia and Providence, but I finally got on digital.
Now that's interesting. I guess Providence must have been the big haggle.
Yes. Either Providence or Philadelphia was always on 6, never Schenectady. But one time I went to Philadelphia and said, wait, why isn't this so old? This is struggling to get in. Then I went to Providence, turned to Providence, that was struggling to get in. Don't tell me that something else was coming in. And then it was Schenectady. It turned north and it was Schenectady.
The Northeast can be difficult for TROP, as opposed to, say, the Midwest, where everything is so flat. TROP can go over hills and occasionally over small mountains. But really, TROP works best on flat terrain. Really, also about an interesting fact about TROP is there's really two kinds of TROP. There is marine TROP and continental TROP. TROP is also called tropo, and the proper name is tropospheric refraction. Ducting is a form of very important. Ducting is a form of tropospheric refraction, in which case the signals actually wind up in a sandwich of layers of air, and where you have a tropospheric duct, a signal gets caught between one layer that tries to bend it up towards space and another layer that tries to bend it back down toward the ground. Wow. Now, most tropospheric reception is not ducting. Some of it is kind of like open ducting, where stuff can get back to the earth. But there are a few cases where you get a duct that is actually so restrictive that the signal doesn't get back to Earth until it gets to the other end of the duct. Several years ago, in a very rare case, I got DXing from just north of Toledo at the southeast corner of Michigan. I had a duct going in which I had almost no trace of the Channel 4 stations. The Channel 4 station near Indianapolis, Bloomington, actually, there was very little trace of it and no trace of Channel 7, Evansville, Indiana. And I thought I was watching the ABC affiliate in Evansville, Indiana, checked the frequency and found out it wasn't the right offset. It turned out I was getting Channel 4 and Channel 7 from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Wow.
684 miles. And to give you an idea, the difference in the azimuth between the station in Bloomington on 4 and the station in Little Rock on 4 was 3 degrees. So the signal from Little Rock was going right over Indianapolis, which was blocked, and it was getting to Detroit. It was a duct. It was actually like a sandwich. But most TROP is simply more of a reflection. Yes, a question from the fellow who gave us the question. I forgot your name.
Mike Lance.
Yes,
I can't understand that why, for example, if you bought a radio station and you tell them that you're trying to listen to this station, and let's say either they have a private station or you're bringing a station up, why is it that they don't seem to care anymore? They used to at one time, where they would say, oh, that great listening or stuff like that. Now they don't seem to care.
It's a sad commentary on the mechanized, pencil-pushing state of society today, because they're actually just trying to sell to advertisers, and they're only going by the stats. And people do tricks to play the stats. The latest thing is they are selling radio stations a box that actually gives them an unfair advantage in making sure that a device called a personal people meter in the rating system actually shows they're listening to that station more than they really are, because it's not affecting the RF transmission. It's only the audio. They're changing the audio so that the personal people meter box knows this. Yeah, this makes it clear he's listening to WOMC rather than CKWW. Just it makes it more obvious to the personal people meet, the portable people meter, that that's a station they're listening to.
What do you use to determine the offset?
There's the old way is tough, and it's almost irrelevant now that there's so little analog television. Traditionally, you would see in the video a pattern of interference. If you had thick bars or a whole picture that throbbed in and out, you knew that the station that was interfering with the one that you were watching was the same offset as the station as were of the same offset. You had to know the offset of one station to know the offset of the interfering station. If there was a fine line pattern, you knew it was a different offset. Where it gets tough is trying to recognize a 10 kilohertz difference from a 20 kilohertz difference. And there was a lot of dispute of this. There were people who thought that a 10 kilohertz offset difference would mean thicker lines than a 20. And there was a guy in New Jersey 30 years ago or so named Bill Faber. And he researched it and found out that the interference at 20 kilohertz actually produces ever so slightly larger lines than 10. So, and I did notice, I did learn eventually to recognize the difference if there were only two stations and the interference was pretty strong and steady. But really, the way to tell an offset, especially now with so fewer stations, is to have a radio that receives narrow band signals in the VHF range. I use a Yaesu VX5 amateur radio handy talkie. It covers all the frequencies from 54 to all the way to 108 and beyond. So with that radio, if I tune in a video carrier buzz on channel 3, if it's 61.24, I know that's a minus offset station. If it's 61.25, a zero. 61.26, a plus. And the same thing goes for the audio carriers as well. So having a selective broadband receiver that can actually tune in those 10 kilohertz differences is the way to do it. It used to be much tougher in the days with recognizing the interference pattern. It was really only reliable watching on TV if you had a known offset station, like in Detroit, WJBK-TV in the analog days, until the last month, was plus, 55.26. And if I saw a station that was throbbing or pulsing, I knew it was also a plus. If it was fine lines, I knew it was a minus or a zero, but couldn't be sure which, usually not be sure which is which.
But it affects every video carrier and the audio carrier, everything is basically.
Right, the whole channel, the video and audio carriers were both shifted down either 10 kilohertz down or 10 kilohertz up or on frequency itself. I was going to say the odd thing is sometimes stations inexplicitly change offset. Channel 2 Detroit, in its last month, using a temporary 1 kilowatt transmitter to show that famous NAB video, they had been working on their new antenna to actually transmit on Channel 7, so they couldn't run 100 kilowatts and have their workers on top of the tower. They put up a little 1 kilowatt transmitter on Channel 2, straight out of the factory, and didn't reset the offset. So they were running zero offset for a couple weeks before they finally went off the air altogether. The offset is intentional. That started in the late 1940s because the FCC originally thought that TV signals would be literally limited to the line of visual sight. So they had TV stations much closer together. And in particular, you had two cases where things were going wrong. You had a Channel 4 in New York City and a Channel 4. Channel 4 was connected before?
Before WRTV.
And they were about to build one in Lancaster. And the same channel, Channel 4, you had stations in Detroit and Cleveland. Yes, WNBK Cleveland was Channel 4. They moved to Channel 3 later because of this. So in the case of Detroit and Cleveland, they thought that because of Lake Erie, that the two wouldn't interfere with each other because nobody lives in the lake. The problem is the situation was worse because over a lake in the spring and summer, you get great trop. So the two messed each other up. So they actually tried to synchronize TV stations so that there would be no beat between the two. And it was very complicated. So they eventually got the idea of just setting them off 10 kilohertz up or down so that instead of having big fat bars or a deep hum, you would have little fine lines that you could only see if you were fairly close to the picture.
Usually happens when there's a temperature inversion, right?
Some form of temperature inversion or simply a temperature gradient can do it. Marine tropo is basically caused by a temperature and humidity gradient. It occurs over oceans and lakes. It occurs over the Great Lakes, too.
I've seen it occur over rivers. I've had it happen over rivers. Big rivers.
Yeah. If the path is pretty much along the Hudson. Yeah. Because what will happen with the Great Lakes, Lake Michigan's a pretty good example. And this is like late spring to early summer, same time of year as sporadic E. Marine trop is almost, it's usually UHF. It doesn't affect VHF much. It can, but it really favors UHF. Marine trop is, I was telling, was saying, was strong in the late spring and early summer. Same part of the season where you get E-skip, and it often happens in the afternoon and early evening. And what happens is you get a nice, warm, summertime humid air mass passes over Lake Michigan, for example. Well, you wind up with Lake Michigan being colder than the dew point of this air mass. So close to the lake, you have cooler, humid air. Well, the speed of light is actually slower in cool, humid air than it is in warm, dry air. And if you take a beam of light and send it over a place where the speed of light is higher up here than down there, what happens? It's just like a camera lens. It causes it to bend. So it's kind of neat to be up in Manistique, Michigan, at the northern end of Lake Michigan, carrying a little portable DTV with an unfurled jumbo paperclip stuck in the antenna jack, and you're watching Chicago.
When there's a temperature, what am I looking for when a continental tropo, other than right. Burns mass?
Yeah, continental tropo is harder to predict. It favors late summer and early fall, and it favors late at night. And it can also happen any time of the year, but its season is not so well defined as sporadic E. There have been some great trop openings around Thanksgiving from time to time. Yeah, anytime. So lost my train of thought. With continent, the best conditions for continental trop to occur are to have almost little or no wind. That goes for marine trop too. Wind is the enemy of tropo.
Oh, I'll have to remember that.
Yes. And little or no wind and humidity near 100% over the entirety of a large area.
Okay.
I mean, if there's a break in the pattern, the duct is cut off. Yeah. So you can have great trop. You could have great trop from Cedar Rapids to South Bend, and you could have great trop from Defiance to Buffalo, but you're not going to make the connection between Cedar Falls and Buffalo because of that one break where there's a thunderstorm or a cool air mass.
High dew points or high humidity?
They're synonymous. A dew point equaling the temperature equals 100% relative humidity.
Yeah, but the thing is that, I'm sorry to get into this with you, but like when it's 90 degrees out, 50% humidity with 90 degrees out is almost unbearable because the dew point would be in the way up there. Yeah, I'm trying to...
Yeah, see, at night the temperatures will cool down, radiational cooling, and the dew point's not going to change much.
Yeah.
So you approach that 100% relative humidity, and that's you get a nice late summer trop opening at night that way.
So it's bottom line, it's humidity, not dew point.
They're related.
Yeah.
They're related. Yeah.
Sorry to.
Yes, Neil.
What are the analog stations going to eventually do? The stations on the channels, or what are they going to be using for?
It's hard to say. Of course, the stations. Most of the digital stations are using the same general broad area of frequencies that they were using in analog. They're still the same UHF and VHF channels. Many stations, actually, with the transition in June of 2009, put their digital transmitters, their permanent digital transmitters, on the same channels that they were using for analog before the transition. So channel 11 Toledo is really channel 11. Channel 13 Toledo is really channel 13. Some stayed with their temporary channels. So channel 40 Toledo is really channel 5. Now, because of interference from devices in the home and the need for a fairly large antenna, the industry has mostly shied away from using channels 2 through 6, the low-band VHF channels. Yes, Ryan.
Sorry to interrupt again. I was told that there's this WFDA member who's 60 miles north of Duluth, and he told me that he has an Etiquette antenna. He could get WPVI channel 6 perfect. And then his wife turns on the microwave.
Yep.
And it goes poof.
RFI.
And that's why no one wants to use 2 through 6. Vacuum cleaners, microwaves, computers.
The same thing happens. I've sometimes used an attic antenna on a ranch house. And the same thing happens with a marginal signal of channel 9 Windsor, which actually went to channel 9 digital, and the microwave messes it up.
Wow, that's VHF high.
What? Well, it's to some extent on VHF high, but it is worse on VHF low. Yeah.
VHF low, there were stations that before they went full power in 2009, stations that were running lower power, they were running channel 40 in Tallahassee, VHF 2.
Right. It matters what you're using. If you've got a nice, pretty antenna, a little pretty little antenna in your apartment, and you happen to have a window facing the station, the UHF will come in nicely, and you'll be sunk on VHF. If you've got a nice antenna, preferably on the roof or in the attic, you can get those VHF stations from a considerable distance despite the relative lack of power.
I was in Camilla, Georgia, about 60 miles north of Tallahassee 1 month, and I could skip all of the Tallahassee commercial stations, not the WFSU, that's further south. But I could get all the UHF 50 miles north of Tallahassee, and go over to 10-5. Albany, Georgia, Channel 10, forget. The current station nearby, which is in Georgia. It was on
RF6, and yet I've seen them from Temperance, Michigan.
And I couldn't get
it all has to do with the antenna you use. I might mention that digital TV very much favors outdoor antennas. On VHF, high and low, because the outdoor antenna gets you out of locally produced interference. Converter boxes and TV sets themselves are a major source of interference. I've got a fairly good converter box. I have a collection of the things. Yep. Called a Zinwell, which is actually pretty sensitive, and it's pretty good at dealing with multipath, which we might get to later. But it has a plastic cabinet. And I was playing with it, portable, with a battery pack, about 35 miles northeast of the Southfield Tower Farm. And I noticed that Detroit's channel 2, which I said is actually on channel 7 now, if I went to that channel, it would show a couple seconds of video, drop out. Then you'd see a couple seconds of video, and it would drop out again. And the cycle would repeat. The problem was, once it locked on the video signal, the digital signal, once it had a lock on the digital signal and the computer started converting that digital signal into a picture, the RF noise from producing that digital picture came up and interfered with the reception of the station, which caused it to drop down. Now, now that it's no longer decoding the picture, the RF noise is gone, and the station can come back in again, only for the process to repeat.
So it depends upon the processor that's doing the filter to whatever the TV's using.
They have pretty much the same processor. What you have to do is you have to isolate the antenna from the receiver. And I've been, I guess we're pressed for time, but I will want to bring up the point of the other major form of propagation affecting television is sporadic E-skip. And this is not the same as the nighttime skip that affects the AM broadcast band. It is highly unpredictable. You don't know when it's going to happen, but it tends to happen in the summer, in the late morning, and around dinner time. It can also happen a little in the winter. It's extremely rare in the spring, in the early spring. Yes, around the solstices, more the summer than the winter. And this is a great mode of propagation because it gives you really strong signals from very great distances. Now, digital TV has wiped out almost all the local low-band signals, but there's still analog signals for the rest of this year from Mexico and for years to come from Cuba and Central American countries. So one aspect of this digital change is where I had never seen a station by E-skip from more than about 1,400 miles in 30 years of DXing. Come the transition, I've seen 8 stations from Mexico, 2 from Nicaragua, 1 from Honduras, 3 from Colombia, and
South America,
because the American station in the past, the American stations would be so much more powerful coming in on a straight single 1,000-mile hop that they would completely obliterate any evidence of the distant foreign stations behind them. Now they're out of the way, and I set an interesting record last year. There was a strong E-skip opening that was out of my reach, linking DXers in the South Central U.S. to a lot of stations in Mexico. Then, while that was going on, I still had my TV on, hoping it would come back, and then pop! Some meteor came flying in over the central part of the U.S., linked the two openings together, and it just, incredible luck, it was exactly at midnight. A huge, huge logo of a ball with a plus sign and a V in it. Guadalajara, Mexico, by both E-skip and meteor scatter at the same time, which is a record for meteor scatter reception of a TV signal. All right. Thank you very much for the time.
That was a nice break, Robert. Thank you.
All right. I want to just very, very quickly respond to a couple of things that Robert said, and we'll be talking about this for those who are interested. Later tonight after the ball game, we'll do kind of a late-night bowl session for whoever is interested in experiencing some high-quality bowl. Just very quickly, the technology that Robert referred to at the beginning is something called Voltaire. And to back up, who's familiar with the concept of PPM metering for FM ratings? See a couple of hands, including the one that I certainly would have expected for FM. It is also an AM, yeah. So what PPM is, just in a very, very, very brief nutshell, and we'll talk much more about this later, it is designed to hide a signal underneath the audio that's already in the main audio channel of the station that you're listening to. So if you have a station that is playing, let's say, high-energy top 40, if you were to show the spectrum analysis of that signal, you'd be seeing pretty constant peaks on just about every frequency that there is to imagine. If you were showing, let's say, or if you're playing a recording of this session, there are pauses. And people, when they're just using voice, and there's no music underneath, then there's different frequency distribution to all of our voices. And so the idea is that this encoder, in trying to be inaudible, will not insert these tones, this coding, if it knows that there's not material to mask it. So if you have loud pulsing top 40 music, there's always something there that will mask these tones. And the idea is these things are supposed to be incredibly robust. The way that you test them, I kid you not, when Arbitron and now Nielsen set these up, you would install the box in your audio chain at the station. You would call them up over the phone. You would hold the phone up to a speaker playing your station. And the idea was if they could decode through that horrible audio coming back over the phone that there was data content there that would identify the station, your coding was working, you were good to go. But people found that there were all of these issues with certain DJs' voices, with certain talk show host voices, with certain formats, that they weren't necessarily providing enough content under which this coding could be masked. So we'll talk more about that later tonight, about what it is they're trying to do with Voltaire, because it is massively, hugely, enormously controversial right now, to say the least, within the radio landscape. We'll also talk a little bit later, just to whet your interest. You might want to ask about this on our next tour over at WFWA as well, about the coming change in the TV spectrum and the FCC's plans to change everybody's channels again, carve out still more space out of the UHF spectrum to be used for non-broadcast purposes by wireless carriers, and make everybody else end up on new channels again. But there may be a benefit for us, because they're also going to change the way that these signals are encoded in a way that should make them a lot more robust and allow them to better survive the trip through various modes of DX propagation to you. And just to give you a little taste, I got an email last night from our Vice President of Engineering. Some of you who were at the WXXI tour a few years ago met Kent Hatfield, our VP of Engineering. He was just down in Cincinnati the last couple of days, and if I hadn't been busy getting this ready, I would have driven down and met him there. They were doing tests of what's called MPEG-3, which is the new form of coding they're going to be using for digital TV. And he said they were buried deep in a hotel basement with just a little whip antenna on back of the receiver on signals that barely even registered on a spectrum analyzer, and it was decoding 4K pictures out of that. And they also went on... They also went on a test. You know, our current DTV system doesn't work if you're moving. They went on a test in a van doing 60 miles an hour. Perfect HD pictures in there, too. So there's this interesting stuff coming down the pike. It will not require a new antenna, because RF is RF. Will it require a new tuner? That depends. That depends, because Mexico is already using MPEG-3. And so a lot of these newer TVs, you know, like that one there, I know was brand new because it wasn't here when I was in this room looking at it in December. It may very well be able to decode ATSC3, except for the change in modulation. There's always a catch. Doug, you're going to be around later for this too, aren't you? Good. Good, because Doug will correct me on everything that I don't get right, because he's even more in the likelihood is it will take the form factor of something like an Amazon Fire Stick, or something like that, where you just plug it into an HDMI port and it does its thing. But we will talk more about that tonight. So, with great thanks to Mark and to all of our presenters who shared their knowledge, especially to Robert for his wonderful impromptu session just now. Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Neil. Thank you, everybody who helped put this together.